This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Hopefully there's this some sort of balanced peace that can be made between humans and the water that dominates our planet, and that is a very powerful force.
As major weather-related calamities like Hurricane Sandy are teaching us, decisions around where buildings are built and trees are planted are important, especially as they relate to the encroaching coastline and other impacts of climate change. This week on Sea Change Radio, we hear from Meera Subramanian, a writer whose recent piece in Orion magazine explores post-Sandy restoration efforts that draw upon engineering insights from 100 years ago and may reach far beyond the shores of Long Island and New Jersey. Then we revisit my discussion with Chris Cannon of Empower Playgrounds, an innovative nonprofit that provides equipment to West African villages that converts the energy of playing kids into electricity for their families. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by environmental journalist Meera Subramanian. Her latest piece is in Orion magazine entitled The City and the Sea. Meera, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex.
Your recent piece in Orion chronicles the efforts of people both from the past and present who are trying to help insulate communities from the effects of climate change. First, if you can talk about what inspired the piece, Meera.
I think you hit right on it, Alex, in terms of looking to the past to figure out how we're going to adapt to a changing climate. This piece came about because I've written for Orion several times before, and they're working on a whole series on infrastructure in America. So this piece is actually one of those that is specifically addressing different issues around America that are issues of infrastructure. And Hurricane Sandy, when it hit New York, I think was a real wake-up call for a lot of Americans. More than half of all Americans live on the coastlines, and that storm really brought forth how quickly that situation can change from a place that is a desirable place to live to a place that has a lot of challenges. And if you're looking at a combination of increased sea level rise combined with more storms that are less predictable, you've got a kind of lethal combination. So it's a huge question facing not just America, but places all around the world.
And from reading your piece, there's two pretty interesting ways that man can work with nature to try to limit the encroaching sea level rise. One is oysters, and the other is dunes. First, why don't you tell us about oysters and how they could potentially help the people of Long Island and the greater metropolitan New York area?
Yeah, both of those ideas also are kind of, again, looking towards the past and towards the way that coastlines naturally form. The part about oysters, for the story, I spoke to Kate Orff, who's a landscape architect in New York City, and she's the one who's really promoting the idea of oyster texture, she calls it. So the idea that you're creating these underwater systems where oysters can thrive, and that seems novel, but that's actually just drawing on an idea. I mean, 200 years ago, oysters were the hot dog of New York City. Millions and millions of oysters were pulled out of the harbors and eaten with abundance. It was a readily available food. And over the years, you know, the shipping came in and very hard structures were made to really clearly define where the water ended and where the city began, with bulkheads and these kind of firm, hard architectural elements. And all of those oyster underwater systems, which were, Kate explained, was like an underwater bathymetry. So you've got this whole 3D complex landscape of things happening under there, and oyster reefs were a huge part of that. And the effect that had then, which it could have again, is that when you have storm surges, when you have incoming waves hitting and battering a shoreline, all of that action, underwater action, helps basically mitigate a lot of that impact because it's slowing down the waves. It's absorbing some of the impact. Wetlands also, of which we've radically transformed over the past few hundred years, also were these huge sponges that served the same purpose. So again, this story was so much about like looking and drawing on the past to understand how we can kind of work with those natural systems to help foster shorelines and coastlines that are both enjoyable to be at and support healthy ecosystems and species that are non-human, as well as making humans a little safer from some of these storm surges.
And then the dunes. You live in Cape Cod, correct?
Correct. I live in Cape Cod, but I actually grew up on the Jersey Shore. And dunes are another. They're just a great way for there to be a buffer zone between the wilds of the ocean and the places where humans live. And so these places are not just the sand. In fact, the sand, what we think of as dunes, is just a small part. It's much more about what the sand supports. And so as much as possible, you want to have a living ecosystem as part of those dunes.
I know when I think of a dune, it's planted in my brain as a little boy went to Cape Cod, and there's like these crater dunes that are on the way to Provincetown and one of the most narrow parts of Cape Cod. And I don't know if you...
Yeah, absolutely.
So I remember just bounding down these things like you're on the moon, but the double dune system and the planted dunes are very different, correct?
Correct. The natural dune systems, I mean, these are very dynamic systems. They're constantly shifting and changing, but they're actually pretty hardy. And when there's a good plant system that's embedded in them, they can be even hardier. There have been like encouragement of building dunes. There's a lot of bringing sand in and planting it, especially on the Jersey Shore where I grew up. That was just an ongoing ritual. And in places that I went to for the reporting on this story in the Rockaways, that is just an annual ritual that they're dredging up sand from farther out the coast and bringing it and dumping it on. But it's this ongoing act of replenishment is what they call it. But the idea is to create something that's a little more long-term. And so the work I focused on there for the piece was looking at some architects that are looking at the Rockaways. That there are small areas where there are some dunes, and they're often planted with beech grass, which is nice and hardy, but they're promoting actually a double dune system where you have a first layer of dunes that has beech grass in it, and then a second layer of dunes that's actually much more developed ecosystem where you actually have a small forest. You have trees, you have shrubs, you have a multi-story canopy. And this, again, is just like a nice second layer and buffer that can act as a really important way to just hold the coastline in place, hopefully help reduce some of that need to be constantly bringing and replenishing sand every year. And then again, when storm surges and these big storm events happen, that it creates this really important buffer between land and sea. There was actually something that didn't make it into the story about some of the people who are doing some of this dune restoration and gardening work in the Rockaways. They just stuck just like little straws into dunes. And then they took photographs of it over the course of a month. And they actually saw sand build up just around the straws. It wasn't even anything living. There was no root system to help hold the the undersurface part together. But even just that act of putting something there physically acted almost like it creates a sort of a magnetism that helps attract other sand. And so even experiments like that. And so the fellow that I started the story with is a guy named Richard George, and he was given some money. He's an artist who lives down in a cottage right close to the shore in the Rockaways. And he was given money 20 years ago to plant some trees. So he didn't really know where to plant them. So he just walked down the street to the beach and started planting trees. And that area, I walked there with him, and it was an area that 20 years ago when he planted the trees, you could have just walked straight under the boardwalk without hitting your head. It was probably 15 feet between the level of the sand and the level of the boardwalk. And now the dunes, there were 15-foot trees there. There was bushes and shrubs of all different kinds, and the sand had basically collected all the way up to the bottom of the boardwalk. So just that process of planting things holds things in place, and then as things get held in place, more and more sand develops. So it's almost can be a self-perpetuating system if it's encouraged in the early stages. Thank you.
dawns, broken even on an empty horizon. No reason for folding, no reason to stay. It's too soon to be leaving, too late for criticizing. And the sands of Nevada go drifting away.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to environmental journalist Meera Subramanian. So, Meera, legendary New York City Parks Commissioner Robert Moses was this visionary of the 20th century and probably our best-known urban planner here in this country. As you wrote, he favored parkways over parks. But if he were redesigning New York City for the 21st century and beyond right now, with the looming threat of climate change as a reality, how do you think a Robert Moses might approach it differently this time?
Hopefully he would have maybe learned some lessons both from from the ecology around him as well as just how people responded to some of the changes that he made to New York in the last century. But I think one element is just making the zone between land and sea a little more amorphous that it used to be, with wetlands and dunes and these kinds of things that helped make that barrier softer. And it seems like there's been a strong move within public policy planners now to try to embrace that a little more and allow, you know, some of the design elements, for example, for Lower Manhattan, which may or may not be implemented, but some of the ideas were sidewalks that could absorb water, and just trying to think of some of these areas that we know will be facing increased impact from the oceans with sea level rise and storms, to just accept that and work with that and figure out how to incorporate design elements that basically embrace that and make it so that it's not so traumatic when it does happen.
But also it sounds like the futuristic vision that urban planners are using today are, like you mentioned, hearkening back to the past and probably a lot farther back than Robert Moses was looking, because in his era, in the 30s, this was just the tail end of the Depression, and the automobile was looked at as an enabler and a terrific opportunity for the individual and freedom. But we look at freedom as more than the individual act of driving these days in this country. So do you think that Robert Moses might agree with this, even if it is an antiquated vision?
He was just looking at how to connect all these communities all over the New York City region with this most modern device of automobiles, like that we're just providing mobility and freedom to people. And I think people recognize that you reach a limit with that. And you, if you provide a public transportation system that is really comprehensive, people can move about the city without spending half of their journeying time looking for a parking space. And New York City is really phenomenal in that way, where you can literally go from Manhattan all the way to a wildlife refuge on the subway with about a 15-minute walk. And there's not many places in the country or in the world that you can say that. And so the places in the Rockaways are actually looking at some of the former Moses's, the legacy left by Robert Moses in the Rockaways is this 2-mile stretch that they call the highway to nowhere, because it was once going to be this huge highway that connected the entire span of the Rockaways, but most of it didn't end up getting built. So you have this just a small 2-mile stretch along the southern coast of the Rockaways. That's this huge 2-4 lane highway, but it doesn't really go anywhere. And that's actually where some of the landscape architects are proposing that this double dune system be incorporated there in the Rockaways, that they actually reclaim some of this highway, turn it into a modest two-lane road, which is all you really need there, and then use the rest of it to create an entire boardwalk double dune system that people can recreate and enjoy, and that also serves to protect the community when storms come.
And one of the people from Rockaway that you quote in the article, Walter Meyer, who's an urban planner there. Actually, let me just read you your quote here, because I think it encapsulates a lot of what we're talking about here. He says, "This is a story about trees. It's less about the dunes than what the dunes support, this coastal forest. It's a living armor. The Dutch don't build dikes anymore. They're building sandbars and sand dunes. The Japanese are building forests. The Australians are building reefs." So I thought that was telling.
Yeah.
That you think of the reason why Holland is still safe in the age of rising sea levels is because of their dikes, but that's not necessarily the case.
Right. And also recognizing the differences between places. The North Atlantic on that side of the Atlantic just isn't quite as vulnerable to the types of storms that we get on this side of the pond. So I think that's another thing, is just how localized some of these initiatives need to be, where you really need to understand the local ecosystem to understand how best to work with it.
So as you were researching this piece, what were some of the lessons that you think can be learned beyond the New York City area, but in Cape Cod or even in the Heartland?
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. Just with, there's been a huge mudslide in Washington. I think it is important to recognize with Colorado flooding that we are dealing with these changes in weather are having impacts everywhere, whether you're on the coast or inland. And even Hurricane Irene, even more than Sandy, was devastating to people that were inland. And so I think you're right that there needs to be consideration of these things across the board. I think one thing that that did come up in the story is another place that I looked at in the New York City area was Staten Island. And there's one community in Staten Island called Oakwood Beach, and they're retreating. You know, they just realized they were in a really vulnerable place. They're 5 feet above sea level. Just the natural formation of where the neighborhood had formed 100 years ago was a natural bowl. So when Sandy came, the water breached, and then it just stayed in there, and they were literally in a bathtub with 10 feet of water, just completely inundated. And 3 people died in that neighborhood, and the state, New York State, ended up buying out at pre-storm values the majority of those homes. Some people have chosen to stay in that area, but most of the community of several hundred people have taken the money and left. And so this concept of managed retreat, I think, is going to be part of the dialogue, because there's just some places that all the strategies in the world are not going to make them safe necessarily. And so if we value human life, if we value property, then we might seriously need to think about just stepping a little bit away from some of these areas. So I think that is going to be part of the equation.
And essentially what we're talking about here is man tempering his thirst for the ultimate oceanfront view and taking a few dozen steps back before building.
Right. I think that's really true. That even that Oakwood Beach place in Staten Island, it was a place where tiny little cottages were built as little summer seasonal uninsulated houses 100 years ago. And it was almost, you could look back wistfully and say, oh, those people knew that that's not a place that you want to be in the storm season or when things get tough, or that you don't want to depend on that as your sole home, where you have nowhere else to go. But over the years, you know, things get insulated, it becomes high value real estate, and people started staying. So, and that's happened all over the place, especially on the East Coast, where there's been a lot of coastal development. And your point about the views is really important. It's part of the, kind of the fight over dunes in New Jersey and in New York, is that dunes do ruin views. It's true. And that is going to be, have to just take it into consideration of whether, you know, New York City wants to look at another $19 billion worth of damage, or whether somebody's million-dollar view. And you have to, those are costs that just need to be weighed. And I feel like you mentioned people in the Heartland earlier, and I know that I've heard from people on reporting on other stories that, you know, there's an element of resentment of that they're having to pay for protecting homes that are in these coastal areas that are not being affected in the same way that they are.
Yeah, I guess it does get into kind of a class issue. Let's say we're all members of the same insurance company. Should insurance customer A have to shoulder the bill for insurance customer B, who has this spectacular home overlooking the ocean but is now precariously situated? It's an ethical conundrum.
Yeah, on the anecdotal level, what I heard repeatedly from people was how much the insurance companies weren't even really there when it came down to it. Just on an extremely anecdotal personal level, my cousin was hard hit by Sandy on the New Jersey coast. He lost a car, and the whole bottom level of his house needed to be gutted and redone, and insurance covered, you know, a third of it. So, and there were other people who told me that the percentage was even less, and they were outright mad at the insurance companies.
Oh, I know. Well, I have a lot of family who was down in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and one of my best friends, I remember he had his whole first floor of his house had been ruined, but the insurance company would only pay for a third to a half because they were saying, well, the top half's fine. But of course, there's no way to access the second floor of your house if the first house, right. The first floor is totally ruined. So these are anecdotes, obviously, and insurance companies are not the only problem here. We all have to kind of find a way to harmoniously go about our business while nature seems to be going about its business, which is kind of the main takeaway I got from your piece.
I think one thing that hopefully I have readers take away from the story is just the ideal that that there can be a third way to look at the natural systems of the ocean and the waters that surround us and understand and learn how they operate so that we can build coastlines and engineer, but in a soft way, with soft engineering that really embraces natural ecosystems and the way that they work. The hope is that we don't have to both build gigantic barriers and hope that the water never breaches them, nor that we just leave our coastlines behind and run away to the hills. Hopefully there's some sort of balanced peace that can be made between humans and the water that dominates our planet, and that is a very powerful force.
Well, it's certainly a powerful piece, and I suggest our listeners check it out in the most recent issue of Orion Magazine. Environmental journalist Meera Subramanian, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now by Chris Cannon. He's the executive director of Empower Playgrounds. Chris, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. This is a good opportunity. Happy to speak with you.
So tell us about your technology. A lot of us have thought about sometimes if we could just harness the kinetic energy of our kids into something useful, this would be great. And you've actually put this into action.
Definitely. So we're actually a nonprofit operating in Ghana. And what we have is a merry-go-round that generates electricity that's used to charge portable LED lanterns. So essentially, kids come to school, they play on this merry-go-round during recess and during breaks, and then it provides lighting for them to do homework, to read, to study together, once they get home in the evenings after the sun has gone down.
What is the breakdown between solar and kinetic energy in your technology, Chris?
As part of the system, there's a small solar panel that mainly supplies power for the electronics in the charging station. So there's a controller and an inverter as a way to, you know, change the power so it's usable and stored in the battery, and also a way for us to track how much is generated and how much is used to charge the lanterns. The solar panel essentially provides enough to keep everything running on long breaks, on weekends, on holidays, so that the battery doesn't get discharged too much, because that really cuts down on the lifespan, which would increase our maintenance cost. So almost all of the power that's used to charge these LED lanterns comes from the merry-go-round, and it's essentially a windmill with a merry-go-round placed on top. So inside there's kind of an output maximizing gearbox, which helps it remain fun for the children to play on. We really didn't want this thing to be like a work wheel where it was a one-to-one ratio. So the gearbox allows it to free spin a little bit while increasing, kind of stepping up the RPMs that then go to a windmill generator that has rare earth magnets in it and coils. And that's what actually creates the energy, which is then transferred through underground cables that we bury that go to the charging station inside the schoolhouse.
So what's the focus of the program once you've harnessed this kinetic energy from playgrounds, Chris? Do you light up playgrounds as well as give lanterns to kids to bring home?
Our focus is actually on providing educational opportunities, more access to learning for students who live in these really remote, deprived areas. So all the communities we work in are without access to the power grid. So this merry-go-round actually charges portable lanterns made by Energizer, that students charge at school and then take home and do homework and read for up to 2 weeks, and then they bring them back and charge them again.
How many lanterns are being powered on a nightly basis by these kids playing on an average-sized playground?
Well, we have 40 schools across Ghana with about 8,000 students, and there are probably, there are 40 lanterns at each school. So it's a pretty expansive program for how small of an organization we are. We maintain all of this with one full-time and one part-time staff in the U.S. and then two full-time in Ghana.
Have you gotten any feedback from teachers in the school that are saying that now that the kids know that their playing is going to light up their houses, are the playgrounds getting more actively used?
Definitely. In almost every single community we work in, this is the only kind of formal playground equipment. Children are playing with, rudimentary cars they make out of tin cans. They're playing with car tires, rocks. They play together because they don't have other toys to play with. So what we see is that initially the attendance at school goes up because children are excited to have something that's different. You know, in a village where everything is kind of earth-toned, these primary colored merry-go-rounds really stand out. They look very foreign amidst the landscape.
Can you walk us through what the economics are for one playground?
So the entire cost for one of our systems is $10,000. So that includes the electricity generating merry-go-round with all of its components, the charging station with all of the electronics, the solar panel, which feeds the charging station, 40 LED lanterns, the shipping, and the installation.
All of that for $10,000?
All of that. And the system, we have wonderful sponsors we work with, like Energizer, PlayWorld Systems, Goal Zero. And the equipment that we have through them has such a long lifespan that it really breaks down that cost to about $10 a year per student. So it's a really digestible low impact cost when you look at it per student.
Chris Cannon, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Great to talk with you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by the Budos Band, Mark Knopfler, and Levon Helm. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidioedu.org.
check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.